Hi, Mark Thompson here. I know there haven't been any regular House of Comments podcasts for the last, well, few months, really. There's been a couple of one-off specials. Part of the reason is because I've been preparing for a new radio show that I'm doing from an actual proper radio studio. The format isn't exactly the same as the House of Comments. It's a topical news, current affairs-based show, sort of, although I sort of go off on tangents at various things. And normally have a couple of guests, and there is some music. I've actually edited the music out here because I thought that listeners to the House of Commons might be interested in listening to the episodes after the broadcast. Anyway, I hope you enjoy it. Hello, you're listening to The Music Mill. I'm Mark Thompson, here with you through till about 9:30, talking about some of the top news stories of the last few days. Coming up in the next half hour, I'll be speaking to Rupert Myers, a Conservative commentator and activist, about Tory conference and how David Cameron's speech has gone down, amongst other things. And then after 9, we'll be looking at top TV defections in the light of BBC economics editor Robert Peston's decision to move from the Beeb to ITV. We'll be joined by cultural author and commentator Tim Worthington to talk about Morecambe and Wise and various other historical acts and shows who have jumped ship from one channel or another. If you want to get in touch, I'm on Twitter at Mark Reckons, and you can tweet me about anything that we're talking about, or indeed anything that's on your mind. So, as I mentioned, we are now going to be speaking to Rupert Myers, who is a political commentator and Conservative activist. Hi, Rupert.
Hello, good evening.
Good evening. Very good to speak to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
No problem. Okay, so you were actually at a Conservative conference over the last few days, is that right?
Indeed, yes, I was. It was a very, very dramatic and interesting experience. I've never been to a political event like it, certainly not with the levels of activism outside. It was quite exciting. I also got a chance to go down and see Jeremy Corbyn and Owen Dynes and everyone else speak, so I saw both sides of the experience. It was good fun.
I mean, that must have been quite surreal to be at Tory conference and yet be going off to see the Labour leader and one of the main kind of left-wing activists, kind of, tub-thumping just down the road.
It's quite unusual. I think it somewhat lowers Jeremy Corbyn's standing to go and be an activist outside the opposition's, or sorry, the government's political conference. I mean, he obviously disagrees. This is his new way of doing things. But I think it makes him look just a little bit trivial to go and have a rally right outside the government's conference. But it was certainly very interesting, and a lot of people went along and seemed to enjoy it. Lots of people very much in favour of nationalising things and unionising things. And, they cared about it very passionately.
Yeah. So why was it such an unusual Conservative conference, then, as you alluded to?
Well, I mean, I've never been to a Conservative Party conference where they were the majority party in government alone.
That shows how young you are, Rupert.
That in and of itself it was a bit of a mood change. Certainly, having been in Labour's Brighton conference last week, Conservative Party conference was a much cheerier affair. People were drinking for very different reasons at the Labour Party conference last week.
Well, indeed. So, I mean, what were the standout moments of conference? Because there's been a few speeches that have been remarked upon for various reasons. Obviously, Boris Johnson made what, by wide acknowledgement, was a fairly barnstorming speech. And Theresa May made a speech which has, let's say, had rather mixed response. And George Osborne, obviously, had a good slot and put his point across. And then we've had David Cameron today. So, I mean, which of them stood out the best for you?
Well, I think you've got to distinguish. I certainly distinguish between those speeches that get a lot of people quite excited and interested in a very short-term basis. And I think Boris and Theresa's speeches very much fit into that category for different reasons. And those speeches that mark something slightly more momentous and somewhat more long-lasting in the history of the party. And I think there, really, it was George Osborne and David Cameron who, between them, have really tilted the party and pivoted and used Corbyn's victory and indeed their own victory to take the Conservative Party in a quite a fundamentally different direction from that it might have been heading in, say, 5 or 10 years ago. But it's quite phenomenal now, their confidence within their own party and accepting, you know, the sort of slightly more right-wing elements to it, their confidence to take their party somewhere which is absolutely slap bang in the middle of, and this is a big debate I know today, but whether it is really the middle of UK politics or not, that's certainly where I see it as being. A lot of people on Twitter saying no, this isn't centrist politics at all, but I think a lot of people at Conservative Party Conference made the point somewhat smugly that Twitter ain't the same thing as the British public at large. So I think that Boris does a fantastic job of getting everybody very excited. There's no doubt that he's an absolutely first-rate speaker, and certainly speaking to him on 2 nights ago, I think it was, and challenging him on whether he's going to take a bigger part in the Leave the EU campaign. He may become a real force within the Conservative Party, but at the moment, there's just a feeling that he's something of a sideshow for the activists. He doesn't seem to be in a position at the moment, and maybe he can pivot into one by, as I say, leading the exit campaign, where he's really in a position to change very much. And as for Theresa, well, I think a lot of people outside of and inside the conference will agree with her. Many people, of course, won't. But I think that her speech really was, again, a bit like Boris sitting down a marker. It doesn't really change anything. Whereas George Osborne and David Cameron, my God, they're part of a real concerted effort now to render Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party a political relevance. And if they can pull that off, that would be something.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said about Boris Johnson there, because I've seen quite a lot of commentary talking about how he seemed to set Cameron an impossible test when he was talking about trying to... What he seemed to be implying was that we should change the fundamental rules of freedom of movement within the EU. And, I mean, that's something that he must know. David Cameron isn't going to be able to deliver. Angela Merkel will never allow it, and there are plenty of other leaders of EU countries that also wouldn't allow it. So that's been interpreted as his first big statement that he may well break ranks and actually try and lead the out campaign. I mean, do you think there's anything to that?
Well, political geek that I am, I also watched Angela Merkel and Francois Hollande in the European Parliament today, and it was a wonderful moment after Nigel Farage had upbraided both of them that Francois Hollande responds and says, well, look, you know, there's only one way of getting what you want, Mr. Farage, and it's to leave the European Union and, in fact, to leave democracy, because we're going in one direction here. And it's certainly a huge amount of confidence from Hollande and Merkel that there ain't going to be a great deal of change. And that's certainly my reading of the situation. There just isn't the time, there isn't the political will in the other 27 member states for there to be a fundamental redrawing of the rules. I think what's much more likely is that Europe is now heading, and this was very much what Guy Verhofstadt was arguing for in the same meeting, Europe is heading towards much greater integration. And so I think what Cameron's going to be able to do, hopefully, is just to say that the UK is not going to play a part of that. And so actually we'll be distinguishing ourselves from them, not by pulling out more, just by not integrating more. But as for your point about Boris Johnson, well, yeah, as I said, I mean, there are rumours all over the place that he's in talks with this guy Dominic Cummings, who's helping to set up and lead and organise the Brexit campaign, the official one, once the official designation is handed out. And Boris didn't deny to me that he was in talks with Dominic. So I think it's his best bet. I think his best bet is to lead the Brexit charge. I'm not sure he'll be successful in the nation, but he'll definitely be successful in capturing the hearts and minds of the majority of Conservative members on that score. And so he could end up being the kind of Jeremy Corbyn to George Osborne's Andy Burnham if he can undermine the front runner by tacking towards the kind of natural heart of his party rather than their heads. That's probably his best bet right now.
Yeah, because there's even a possibility that even if, as certainly looking at polls at the moment, is most likely remaining in the EU wins, but a bit like with Scotland, if in wins but not by a huge margin, then people associated with the out campaign could actually reap quite big electoral dividends. And given that, I mean, you'll know this better than I do, Rupert, but being a member and taking the temperature, but it almost seems like being a better off outer, or at the very least being highly sceptical, is almost an article of faith for most Tory activists. And ultimately, they're the people who will have the vote once the MPs whittle it down to two. So if Boris can end up in the final two and he's led the out campaign and seem to have done a good job with that, even if they don't win, that could be a very potent combination for Osborne to be facing in a few years' time, couldn't it?
Yeah, it's absolutely his best bet. And, of course, it's far too early to be looking at all this, because goodness knows what's going to happen in the interim. But if we're going to go there, then George Osborne has to learn the lessons, and David Cameron has to learn the lessons of the Labour leadership election, make sure that Boris Johnson doesn't get on that ballot. You know, he hasn't been an MP, at least this time around, for very long. He hasn't got the kind of networks within the party that George Osborne has been cultivating and that David Cameron is still cultivating. Their best bet is to try and lend some votes to someone who's a slightly weaker candidate for that final runoff, and that could be someone like Theresa May, could be someone like Sajid Javid, both of whom seem much more Eurosceptic than George Osborne. Boris himself has had a slightly problematic history on this front. I mean, I don't really remember Boris being epically anti-immigration or epically anti the EU. He certainly made the case for renegotiation, and as the Mayor of London, he's had to defend the city's interests. So it's going to be a tricky part, but you're right, it's his best bet, absolutely, because he's not going to, I don't think he's going to come first among MPs. In fact, I think he's going to have a difficult time getting in that final two.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because, I mean, Corbyn only ended up on the ballot in the Labour contest because of the, charity, really, from a number of MPs who would never have actually voted for him but wanted a wider debate. And I think all political parties have looked at the results of that and shuddered and thought, right, OK, well, let's make sure we never do that. So, and of course, the hurdle within the Conservative Party is that actually there will only be two people put to the members. So given that, it's probably quite easy for Osborne, given his Machiavellian reputation at least, to be able to engineer things so that Boris doesn't end up in the final two.
I mean, I don't know about it's, as I said, we are years off this. And,
it's fun to speculate, though, isn't it?
But if 2015 has taught us anything, it's that goodness knows what's going to happen in the next 2-3 years. I mean, you're absolutely right. If there's one person who can do it, it's George Osborne. And the reason it's George Osborne is because he's got the backing of the Prime Minister. What we saw today and what we've seen over the course of this week isn't the Cameron project. It is the Cameron-Osborne project. And Cameron wants, I think, to do what Tony Blair couldn't do, which is to set in motion a succession that is stable and ensures that this legacy continues.
I think the phrase that Blair used to use was stable and orderly, wasn't it? And I think the transition to Brown was anything but that. So
exactly. And you watch those speeches and the way that they kind of dovetailed each other, and you're like, bloody hell, how have these two guys stayed so firm friends and so loyal to each other and so respectful of each other? Because growing up, all I grew up under was obviously Blair and Brown. It's an absolute miracle, and it's what will enable, if they can pull it off, quite a successful political legacy, because it's not just about policies. It's about the tone of the Conservative Party. It's about the people that it attracts. It's about the people that it selects. It's about the people that it puts into parliamentary seats. It's a fundamental change. It's not just a rebranding. It's a total refocus. And that's and if they can do that, that'll be quite an undertaking. Of course, the fly in the ointment is Europe, and nobody in this conference has managed to get a clap for Europe. Both Osborne and Cameron sort of tried, but only actually really got an applause from the audience when they said, "We don't want any closer union. We want it to stop here." That's when members of the audience clap. That's the final hurdle, really.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, as you pointed out a couple of times, we are speculating about things that, according to Cameron at least, aren't going to happen until 2019, although I'm slightly sceptical about that. I think events, dear boy, might intervene and cause that to happen sooner, but either way, it's at least 2 or 3 years away. So if we could maybe just turn to Cameron's speech today then, because obviously there's been a lot of commentary about he seems to be tacking more to the centre. I was reminded of something that Tony Blair said right at the height of his popularity, when he rather hubristically used the phrase, I think I'm quoting it correctly, that Labour are now the political wing of the British people. And I must say, having watched Cameron today, I'm starting to feel that he probably thinks the same thing now about the Conservative Party. I mean, do you think, I'm sure you wouldn't use those exact words, but do you think that's probably a rough approximation of where he thinks his party is now?
I don't think it's where he, well, it's hard to say exactly. I doubt it's where he thinks his party is. It's where he wants them to be. It's where he is, and yeah. It's where he knows that the majority of the British people are. You look at, this was the thing that was so staggering 12 months ago, was that or less than that, the polling all showed that people agree with the Conservative Party on most things in general, most of them, but that they don't want to vote for the Conservatives. They like the Conservative Party so long as you don't tell them that they're a Conservative Party. And so the Conservatives just about nicked this election on the basis of fears over Scotland, fears over Ed Miliband. It's lots of people sort of just, you know, holding their nose and voting for the least worst alternative. And that's Cameron's problem, is he's for the last 10 years been running on a platform which is, in terms of the arguments it makes, very popular, but just the branding is so desperately toxic, and he knows that because he's tried everything he can to. So I think he's speaking here to try and lead the horse to water, rather than that's because he thinks where the Conservatives are. It's a lot to achieve in 5 years to try and take them to where he wants them to be, but it is definitely possible. It is definitely possible, but what it's done is taken, it's almost the opposite of what Jeremy Corbyn is doing. It's taken the most moderate people who are on the fringes of the Conservative Party and plonked them right in the centre. You talk about Euroscepticism being almost a badge of honour for Conservative members. I know from private conversations with people that the Conservative Party is very keen to make sure that people who get onto, say, the candidates list are not labored Eurosceptics. I know that the people who are at the top of this party, you know, the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, and the people around them, will be making the case to stay in the European Union. So, as I said, it's almost the opposite of the Corbyn effect. It's taken the most moderate, most centrist people, rather than the far extremes, and they've infiltrated and taken over the top of the party. Now, if they can carry the party with them, that will be a phenomenal achievement. There is some obviously question mark as to whether they can do that, but it's a work in progress.
Yeah, I mean, it almost feels like Cameron is trying to, I'm going to sort of make up a word now, but re-detoxify the party. His strategy about 10 years ago, or his tactics, seemed to be with the hugger hoodie and hugger husky and all of that he was trying to detoxify the party, but it sort of felt like when they were in government in coalition, probably partly as a result of how the Lib Dems tried to paint them in coalition, that the party sort of at least half retoxified itself. So do you think he is relaunching his detoxification strategy?
To a certain extent, I wouldn't call it detoxification at this point, because I think that the project has shown that people have voted twice now for a Conservative-led and now a Conservative government. So I think the detoxification has already happened. But what Cameron wanted to do in his first term was modernise, liberalise. As they reached election time, a lot of that had to get junked because it was, you know, to scraping barnacles off the boat, to use the political expression. But now that we are again 5 years from a general election, it's time to relaunch some of those things that will probably again be considered barnacles in 5 years' time. The issues that aren't necessarily going to edge a general election, but that David Cameron cares passionately about and wants to sort out. This is just the perfect time in the electoral cycle for him to go off and do the things that will build his legacy, and that aren't necessarily the sort of really punchy items that make people vote one way or the other in the ballot box. So I think the Conservative Party has been, and this is a very bold statement, but I think it has been generally pretty detoxified at this point. And I think that the British people are pretty happy to vote for it. And it's no longer like it was under, you know, IDS and William Hague, something of a kind of a joke. I think that's Labour's problem now. I think they have their own toxicity issues to address, in the form of, you know, Hamas and the IRA and Osama bin Laden and all the baggage that comes with electing these people. So I don't think that's the Conservative aim at the moment. I think it's just going about securing the things that David Cameron believes in, but that he knows don't win general elections.
I mean, just linked to what you were just saying there, I mean, the tax credits issue, which Cameron didn't really seem to address in his speech today. There's been a lot of talk about it. He's been asked about it a number of times, as have most Tory spokespeople as they've been on the media. And there does seem to be building up a head of steam now behind the idea that actually what Osborne tried to argue during the budget, that the cut in tax credits will be offset by the increase in the minimum wage and other tax changes, just isn't going to fly. I mean, you've even got the Sun now coming out against the changes and talking about having to protect the, you know, the people who are on tax credits who are going to be getting big cuts. Is your feeling, from what you heard and saw at the conference, that actually, ultimately, the government is going to have to do something about this? I'm not saying it's going to be a U-turn, but they're going to have to do something to soften the blow. I mean, the letters to people are going to be going out in the next few months, and, you know, probably the 90-odd percent of people who don't pay that much attention to politics may not really be aware of what's coming down the line. Suddenly, when they see they're going to lose 750, 1,500 or more pounds a year when they're already on a very low income anyway, I mean, that is going to be toxic, isn't it? They are going to have to do something about that.
I don't think they will. I don't think they will. I really don't. I think I think that, again, looking at this from a purely political point of view, I think that this is the time in an election cycle when some of the really tough, hard things have to be done, in the hope that by the time the next election comes around, you know, the government's operating at a small surplus and people are feeling better off because of economic growth and increases in the minimum wage and just a general boost to overall economic productivity. But at this point, I just don't see that. I mean, the Prime Minister, I think, has already ruled out any reform of tax credits. I know that Boris Johnson is sort of using this as a stick to beat George Osborne with, but that's just a minor disagreement between them. Look, there's no doubt that for some people out there, this is going to, well, for many people, it's going to cause a lot of economic uncertainty. But I just don't see the Conservatives pulling back on this. I think you're much more likely to see other measures in the next couple of years if it doesn't work as well as it's hoped to. But I'd be amazed if they went back and changed this now, because the cost of the cost of changing it, when it's, I think it's a policy, it's something like £6 billion. These tax credits would cost next year, just the difference in what's being cut. I can't imagine they're just going to be able to find that money down the back of the sofa, and there isn't a great deal of wiggle room in the budget, as you see every time. You know, the rabbits being pulled out of the hat by the Chancellor are getting much and much smaller and less valuable. This is time to penny pinch, and I don't see that changing. I know that's going to be very painful for them and difficult, but again, this is exactly the time in an electoral cycle when those kinds of hard decisions can be made, and I think they've been made. I certainly didn't hear a lot of people saying, yeah, this is something we have to change. I think, if anything, there's more concern about the row with junior doctors. I think that's something that you're likely to see movement on, because that's an issue that, that's an issue that I have people being quite concerned about.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for your time, Rupert, today, and for a fascinating insight into what's been going on over the last few days. It's great to speak to you. Thank you.
My pleasure, and good luck competing with the Great British Bake Off final tonight.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I'm glad I'm not in the house tonight, actually. I can leave my wife to watch that in peace.
Right, I only noticed it was on because of Twitter. I'm not watching myself. All right, have
great,
a good evening.
Great stuff, thank you. Bye. Okay, so that was Rupert Myers, who is a Conservative commentator and activist. And after we come back, we're going to be talking about, Robert Peston has decided to jump ship from the BBC to ITV. So he's currently the BBC business editor. No, he was business editor. He's now economics editor. And he's about to become political editor on ITV. And this made us think that we'd like to maybe have a little look at some of the famous TV defections of the past. So I can remember just about Morecambe and Wise defecting from the BBC to ITV. I even remember at one point ITV managed to poach Dallas, which my mum used to watch avidly, and I think she was a bit irked about. So we're going to be talking about those and probably lots of other defections with Tim Worthington, who's an author and a cultural commentator. Okay, so now we are going to talk about the TV defections. I'm going to do something that's probably ill-advised first. Greetings, pop pickers. Here are the top 10 TV defections of all time ever. At 2, it's Adrian Childs, who was poached by an ITV executive who one assumes had never seen his work but had £6 million left in his budget, rather like a road worker unnecessarily digging up a sewer. Up at 9, it's Morecambe and Wise, who chased lower ratings to ITV, or Thames Television as it was called back then, Channel 3 if you were my nan. A new entry at 8, it's Todd Carty, who turned his back on the company that paid for his schooling and car mechanic training to join The Bill before collaborating with fellow defectors Schofield, Bleakley, Willoughby on Poor Man's ice-based Strictly rip-off Dancing on Ice. All right. At 7, pen salesman Michael Parkinson moved his periodic interview with Billy Connolly to commercial land for several years. At 6, who is it? Who was it? It's Jonathan Ross, who was shamed by his honour lewdness with the nation's favourite grandfather, 70s Spanish waiter Manuel. Rossi relocated his show Brick by Brick from Ante to create an exact replica on the other side. 5, Anton Deck, who moved from the Beeb after Ant was blinded in a paintball accident. They went on to host every single ITV show broadcast since. 4 saw the coup of the century as Channel 5 secured a move for webcam enthusiast and alleged actor Leslie Grantham from EastEnders to Fort Boyard. Where's the top 3? They're coming. 3, down from 2. He doesn't like foreigners, or women, or foreign women. But he does like cars and punching people in the face. It's Jeremy Clarkson. In at 2, swapping a broom cupboard for a sofa and testing out BDSM equipment and making speculative lists of sex offenders visible to all for daytime TV, it's Philip Schofield. And straight in at number 1, it's Bruce Forsyth. He moved his unique geriatric cabaret from BBC to ITV and back again like a befuddled old man who kept forgetting where he lived. But did he get a nice Brucey bonus? Not half. Okay. So I'm delighted to be joined by Tim Worthington, who's going to talk to us about all manner of TV defections. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mark.
How you doing?
Not too bad, yeah. Interesting that you have Bruce Forsyth at number one, because I think he's... I think that's everyone's number one defection, really. I'm sure we'll come back to that in a minute.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's been lots over the years, hasn't there? I mean, maybe if we can... I mean, the path generally seems to be BBC to ITV, doesn't it? The stars are... kind of incubated on Ante, and then they, I don't know, for whatever reason, maybe for money or just because they're tempted by the bright lights of the commercial channel, they tended to go that way, didn't they?
Yeah, I mean, there's a number of reasons. Most of the time it is money. Sometimes it's been over disagreements. Sometimes it's just because people wanted to try something a bit different. I mean, if you look at... somebody who never actually made the move because he was too loyal to ITV was apparently Benny Hill for years and years. He wanted to get away from all the, you know, all the chase stuff, all the slapstick and so on. He wanted to do more serious things.
that sounds surreal.
Once. Yeah, ITV let him once. It's actually quite good. I've seen it. It's called Eddie in August. I think it's about 1972. But he could have gone to the BBC, I'm sure, and tried something different, but he was too loyal. But I think he's the only person who's ever been too loyal when the opportunities have been waved at them.
Yeah, but I mean, moving from BBC to ITV, I mean, generally, it's not seen as a good move, is it, usually in retrospect? I mean, if you think about Morecambe and Wise, they never really got to the same heights as they had on the BBC, did they?
Yeah, I think it's quite often that people don't realise, you know, how the atmosphere that they sort of learned their TV trade in affected them creatively. I mean, if you look at Morecambe and Wise, before they originally joined the BBC in 1969, they'd been looking around on ITV for a while and never really taken off. They had sort of straightforward variety show, really. And famously, there's a clip of them performing with the Beatles, where they're very much second fiddle to the Beatles, it has to be said. But they went sort of down on their luck. They went to the BBC, and they were stuck with one writer and one studio, really, and they had to improvise around, and that's how they built up the amazing sort of rapport they have with each other and with the audience. And the thing with the celebrity guest started by accident when somebody read Andre Previn saying he liked the show, and they thought, well, we'll get him in as a guest, and it started with that. But then they were offered a lot of money to join Thames in 1978, and they had to leave the main writer behind at the BBC. They were in a completely different arena. They couldn't use News Bring Me Sunshine had a terrible theme song, which is basically about Stalker, as far as I'm concerned. It's called Following You Around.
There was quite a lot of stuff like that in the 70s, though, to be fair, Tim.
Yeah, it's increasingly looking like there was. Quite sad, really, that, you know, they were on Thames for a couple of years, and then Eric Morecambe died. And what people really remember is they went to Thames, in inverted commas, and that's when it all went wrong.
I mean, we mentioned Bruce Forsyth in the rundown, as you said, and he did have a very famous defection from the BBC to ITV, didn't he?
Yes, I mean, that really was money. I think he gleefully says himself it was money, that ITV had a crazy idea. I don't know what anyone was thinking, where, you know, they thought obviously Saturday night was the biggest TV night of the week, and they thought rather than have a lot of different shows, you know, one after the other bringing in the viewers, why don't we just have one show presented by Brucey with bits of other shows in it, where, you know, when you think of it, all rammed into a couple of hours. There was him doing his, you know, bits with the audience, his bits with celebrity guests. There was a couple of revivals of ancient sitcoms that weren't very funny. Rod Hull and Emu, Cannon and Ball. There was a phone-in game called Beat the Goalie. The Pyramid Game started there as well. Quite a lot of the time, there wasn't time to fit everything in. And it was famously, Clive James said, it has no format. It is just a big night. It's just a long show. And people turned off in droves. They really, really found it, you know, unfocused, disjointed, boring, really. And there was a couple of weeks in, Bruce used to do a bit where the audience put questions to him, and somebody asked him a question. Now, I've seen about a minute and a half of this. Somebody said, "What do you think of the criticism of the show?" And he goes into an extraordinary rant about
I've seen it. I saw it as a clip on one of these.
He was going to fly out of the set, or allegedly he goes from one ad break to the other. Now, I've never seen the whole thing, but I could well imagine it, the way he was going on.
Yeah. That's
there's one interesting legacy, though, which is when you think about it, Bruce Forsyth's Big Night, very similar name to a certain comedy show that appeared about 10 years later. And it is not difficult to imagine that, you know, while everyone else was saying, "This is awful," a young Vic Reeves might be watching thinking, "Brilliant, this is so awful." And taking note, and really, Big Night Out was kind of that sort of thing where people just came on and did their act of indifference and went off again.
Did they have someone, like, coming on in like, a motorised vehicle and then dispensing summary justice to the audience?
I'm sure Cannon and Ball probably tried that one week.
That's a reference to Judge Lionel Nutmeg from Vic Reeves' Big Night Out, just in case anyone isn't aware of that. I realise we're getting slightly esoteric here. Is there anyone else who went from BBC to ITV you think particularly stands out as a flop then?
Yeah, quite a few. There was Mel Smith and Griff Rhys-Jones were tempted over when Clive James took a break from Clive James on TV. They were offered the chance to do The World According to Smith and Jones, where basically they did painfully unfunny gags about clips from old sort of historical costume dramas and so on. Every week there'd be a character that looked like Mel that they'd spot. And it really didn't work. And it sat on the shelf for a while. And I think they had actually gone back to the BBC and started again on BBC Two by the time it was shown. John Inman did a couple of terrible sitcoms for ITV where it was basically just Mr. Humphreys watered down. There was Odd Man Out and Take a Letter, Mr. Jones. In the first one, he opens a seaside rock factory, I think. In the second one, he's a male secretary. So it's, you know, every single week the joke was, "But you're a man." "Ooh, sometimes, dear." You know, didn't really work. But the one that really stayed with me, there was, nobody remembers him now, but there's a guy in the 80s called Phil Cool.
Oh, I remember him.
Yeah, he was alternative comedy's impressionist. He was famously called the rubber-faced funny man.
He could literally contort his face into the faces of the people he was doing impressions of. It was quite surreal.
Well, not just people. He did things like lampposts and phones and so on as well. But it was all very good-natured, if a bit irreverent, on the BBC. But he went to ITV for a late-night slot, and it just became unpleasant. He started doing impressions of things like Bugs Bunny in the electric chair was one that I remember, which, that isn't funny, and it's not nice.
Yeah, indeed. OK, but was anyone better having moved from the BBC to ITV? There must have been some people for whom, you know, that was the right move.
Well, not so much that way around. There were people who were better on ITV where they started.
Right.
Because again, I think it's, you know, to do with the creative limits. And on ITV, you know, you've got a shorter running time, it's faster moving, you've got the ad breaks to think of. And that people use that creatively in some ways. I mean, the famous one is Kenny Everett. Kenny Everett was great on the BBC, but he's much, much better on ITV. Because he literally played with the, you know, the whole setup of the way ITV broadcast, and he'd do bits of business with the cue dot for the adverts in the corner.
Oh, yeah, and he'd burst through the Thames Television logo and stuff.
Yeah, that's the one everyone remembers.
Yeah.
And he was never quite as inventive on the BBC. And similarly, people might scoff at this, but Russ Abbott, like him or hate him, he was a lot more anarchic and sharp on ITV. He was very, very fast-moving. He did a lot of pop parodies and things like that. When he went to the BBC, there was, in inverted commas, more room for the sketches to breathe, which seemed to me to be they just did the same sketch again and again, only with slightly different Teddy Boy outfits.
Hmm.
And, of course, Roland Rat disappeared without trace when he moved to the BBC. I think it was in 1986. It was a sort of high-profile transfer. The Christmas Day launch as well, with the big Christmas Day special.
Hmm.
And then the series flopped, and he went on and on through other vehicles like Roland's Rat Race, and by the early 90s, he's in Tales of the Road and Sherlock Holmes.
I mean,
the first thing on children's BBC, and nobody believes me that existed, but it did.
Well, to be fair, though, with someone like Roland Rat, I mean, he had a shelf life, didn't he? Wasn't that always going to happen? I mean, it wasn't
always going to happen that he'd be Sherlock Holmes.
No, that's a fair point. I don't think that was inevitable. I think some kids from my school ended up on some Roland Rat quiz show in the late 80s.
Oh, my cousin was on Roland's Rat Race as well.
Yeah.
Small world.
Yeah, there you go.
The other ones who were much better on ITV were Hale and Pace.
Hmm.
Again, like, they all hate them, but they've been doing what they've been doing very successfully for about 11 years. And then, a bit like Benny Hill, they wrote a comedy drama, I think it was called April Fool's Day. And ITV messed them about over it, and they said, well, we're going to the BBC then. And what happened to them after that?
Wasn't that called something like H at P or something?
H ampersand P
that
at BBC.
Yeah.
Which they were for very long, I don't think.
No, I saw them pop up on Pointless Celebrities the other day, and I do remember thinking, I've not seen these for about 10 years. So I think they did sync without trace. I mentioned in the rundown about Dallas. What happened with that? Because I seem to recall ITV poached it, but then it was back on the BBC really quickly afterwards. I never quite understood what had happened there.
Well, what happened was, I think this might even be the first example of the sort of thing that's, you know, de rigueur now with Sky, where the BBC or ITV shows something for a couple of seasons and then Sky buy the rights and no one can see it.
Yeah.
ITV tried to buy the rights to Dallas, but because of the contractual arrangement, they had to buy the series that was just entering production. The BBC had bought the one before that, which they still hadn't shown.
Hmm.
And Michael Grade, who is a divisive figure, he's had some very good ideas and some very bad ideas, but this is one of his masterstrokes, was he, despite the amount of money they'd spent on it and the amount of criticism he was going to get from politicians for doing this, he just said, well, if they give the rights to ITV, we won't show that series of Dallas. And everyone will be really confused when ITV starts showing it, and they'll have to throw in the towel. And he stared at them, and they blinked, and they gave the rights back to the BBC.
So it never actually aired on ITV, then?
No, there was a trailer, which, that is an urban myth, I remember seeing it, where it sort of had JR sitting at a desk and said, Dallas is coming to ITV.
Like Larry Hagman even knew what ITV was.
Yes.
Yeah, it's always funny when massive stars, you know, do. I've seen them do stuff for Channel 4. I'm sure they don't even know what Channel 4 is.
Well, Matt LeBlanc did the 5 logo, didn't he, when they showed Joey?
Did he?
Yeah.
Well, there was another flop. So there have been shows that have actually just moved between channels, haven't there? I mean, I'm thinking something like Men Behaving Badly. I seem to remember that was on ITV. Was it the first series? And it had Martin Clunes and Harry Enfield.
It was actually the first two. Because, obviously, yeah, it was those two in the first series. And Harry Enfield didn't really work in it.
No.
And I think they were going to give him the shove anyway, but he said at the end of the series, I think you better let me go. And they got Neil Morrissey, and it improved genuinely about 600%. It was already a very funny show. And it won a lot of awards, which in typical ITV fashion, somebody then said, well, if it's proved that successful, we don't have to make it anymore. Like, they still do with things like Primeval now. I don't understand the logic there, but the production team, because it was an independent production, thought, well, this is insane, we're just starting to get somewhere with this. And they took it to the BBC, and it had been a moderate success before, but it immediately took off on the BBC, massively, to the extent that they later bought the ITV episodes and showed them.
Yeah.
But the ad breaks very crudely cut out.
Yeah. I mean, do you think, in a way, it would have done really well on ITV anyway? Because I always associate Men Behaving Badly as kind of capturing that, I hate the word, but I'll use it, zeitgeist of the mid-90s kind of lad culture. And it seemed to just fit in with that, whereas the early series were kind of at the start of the 90s, weren't they, when that wasn't so much in vogue?
Yeah, I mean, it was really an accident of timing. But I think they might have found themselves more constrained on ITV because programme sponsorship was just starting to come in. I think it's got a bit more lax over the years, but I know sponsors were very uptight about what could and couldn't be said initially. And I think that they really would have fallen foul of that. You know, it would have been hard to imagine on the other side of the coin, Red Dwarf being on ITV at that point.
Yeah.
At least in the same form that it was. Red Dwarf, as it later became, could easily have been on ITV.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And also mentioned Jonathan Ross in the rundown there. I mean, do you think... I can't really tell any difference between the show that he did on the BBC and the show he does or did on ITV. Is he still doing it? I've lost track, to be honest.
I think he is. I've never enjoyed it as much on ITV. I'm not sure why, something was just missing from it. But I think, to be honest, obviously following his little bruising encounter, I think he became a lot more restrained anyway, because his radio show, not obviously the Russell Brand one, but his own one that was on Radio 2 in the mornings on a Saturday, that became more restrained afterwards. Not in terms of, he was never extreme or vulgar on it, just he got off into odd flights of fancy, like speculating on when they stopped making Ghosts, which could go on for like 10, 15 minutes, and then That all changed, and it just became about the guests, as though he was frightened that he might go too far.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, we're slightly digressing here, but I do think that is a real shame. I'm not saying what him and Russell Brand did with Andrew Sachs was right, because it really wasn't, and frankly, there should have been an editor who'd stepped in and stopped that and, you know, made sure it didn't go out. And, you know, it's a good argument for saying they shouldn't have done it in the first place, but, you know, if I think of, like, innovative broadcasters, I mean, we were talking about Kenny Everett earlier on, and he actually made his name in radio first with all kinds of different characters and just extemporising and just going wherever the wind took him. And I used to get that feeling with Jonathan Ross when he was on the radio as well. I know exactly what you're talking about. I always far more enjoyed Jonathan Ross on the radio than I ever have done on television. To me, it seems like his natural medium, and I think it's a real shame that he's not on it anymore.
It does. And also, I think the day is going to come when people are going to look back at what he did very, very, very early on in his career. Things like the Incredibly Strange Film Show, the one where he went looking for Elvis impersonators, and, you know, all the quirky documentaries he did. In some ways, he was the... There'd been a couple of people doing that before him. I mean, Jasper Carrot, it gets forgotten that he did a lot of funny documentaries early on. But Jonathan Ross sort of really... He didn't invent it, but he took it into the places it should have gone. I think the day will come when people will look back on all that quite fondly and say, well, he did that quite well, didn't he?
What about Michael Parkinson? Because he went back and forth and back and forth and back again, didn't he?
Yes. He's not a favourite of mine, is old Parky, but literally, genuinely, when I was putting together some notes about his moving between channels, I genuinely couldn't pin down exactly how many times he did and when and where, because he just seemed to zigzag so much, usually in an extreme grump as he did it. And famously, his last significant move was he took the Parkinson show from the BBC to ITV, complaining that it moved him to after Match of the Day, which had previously been his slot for a very long time in the original iteration of the show in the 70s. So quite an odd thing to get agitated over. And there was he of course, he was one of the famous five on TVAM, moaning about the cricket with his jumper sleeves rolled up. And he was very quickly given the boot from there, where he went to, was it Thames? And he did a lot of game shows for a while, and then was back to the BBC. Just back and forth constantly. It's always somebody else's fault. Like, he did Desert Island Discs for a couple of years. And he really, I'm not saying, you know, oh, he was rubbish. He wasn't a good fit for Desert Island Discs, because it sort of required a gentler style of questioning. And he was gone after a couple of years, and he said something like, this is the establishment bully boys don't like a good, honest northerner, you know, doing it, so, or doing their favourite show, so they've edged me out of them. They might not have done Michael.
And is there anything else in terms of moves back and forth that stands out to you then?
Yeah, there's something that will only really be known about by people who are very interested in radio comedy, which I admit is probably a Venn diagram with me and a couple of my friends in it. But there was a point where the BBC dithered so much about their hit radio comedies that they missed out on a couple of big hits, like Whose Line Is It Anyway? Was originally a Radio 4 game show.
See, I didn't even know that.
Yeah, there was that. There was After Henry and Up the Garden Path, which are big ITV sitcoms. Both were on Radio 4 for a couple of years before that. And there was a very early Stephen Fry vehicle, Delve Special, which is a kind of semi-hoax, semi-realistic send-up of sort of Roger Cook consumer affairs type shows, like sort of hard-hitting investigations.
Did that become This Is David Lander on Channel 4?
This Is David Lander on Channel 4.
Right.
After it being optioned to the BBC a couple of times, and they'd sort of gone, well, Stephen Fry is very popular and the show is very funny, but... And Channel 4 dived in and got it.
Yeah. I do remember thinking that was very good. There was a time when the alternative comedy circuit seemed to pretty much own Channel 4, wasn't there?
Yes, yeah.
Okay. Well, the only other thing I really wanted to ask you, Tim, is, I mean, how important do you think this is anymore? Obviously, we're talking about a lot of historic stuff here, but, you know, there's hundreds of channels now, and there's the internet, and all kinds of different ways in which people can consume media. I mean, really, the days of defections really meaning anything. Obviously, we've had Robert Peston announce his defection recently, but really, these things just don't matter the way they used to now, do they?
Well, you say that, but there are still examples of people, you know, just messing up completely and vanishing off the face of the TV map when they do change channels. I mean, who remembers David Dickinson now? It was supposed to be, when he signed up to ITV to do Dickinson's Real Deal, that was supposed to be him, you know, heading for the big time. Never quite happened. Christine Bleakley and Adrian Childs, when they did the high-profile move to Daybreak for the One Show, they didn't last very long on it. And I'm not quite sure what either of them are doing now. But I think it's more about the personality rather than the show now, whereas in a lot of ways in the old days, it was about the effect on the show, really.
Yeah.
And they can kind of, you can kind of pull off moving more or less, you know, your content, your shtick from one channel to another, but not if all it is yourself, really.
Yeah.
That's my rather ham-fisted analysis of it.
Okay, Tim, well, it's been great to talk to you, and how can people find out more about your writings and your online presence?
Best place to go is timworthington.blogspot.co.uk. I can actually say that most days.
Yeah, is that where you set the world to rights, is it?
I set people who like early Pink Floyd and Campbellwick Green to rights. I think that's in the world. Very little actual politics in it, apart from the politics of BBC commissioning editors in 1967.
And you've written some books as well, haven't you? Do you want to just mention those?
Thank you very much. Well, people I think will be most interested in, there's a book called Not on Your Telly. I should get the names of my own books right, which is
pretty good start.
An anthology of writing about obscure TV that I've done over the years. Also Fun at One, which is history of comedy on BBC Radio 1.
Yeah.
Which a couple of people said, how do you fill a book with that? Which is a fair question, but, you know, even just off the top of my head, you've got The Mary Whitehouse Experience, Kenny Everett, Chris Morris, Eric Idle.
Yeah.
goes on and on.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't happen anymore, so it's easy to forget, isn't it, that it was actually kind of a breeding ground for...
Oh, they have started it again.
Oh, really? You see, I'm too old, Tim. I don't listen to it anymore. Yeah, that's the problem. Okay, Tim. Well, it's been great to catch up with you about this, and we'd love to have you back on again at some point.
Thank you very much. I look forward to it.
Great stuff. Thank you. So that's Tim Worthington, cultural commentator and author. Well, I'd just like to thank my guests again. So I'd like to thank Rupert Myers and Tim Worthington. I'll be here every week, Mark Thompson, talking about news stories from the last few days or things that have been inspired by the news stories. You can get me on Twitter @MarkReckons, and I'll be back next week.